Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Those who said I couldn't win as U.S. Senator because I had a funny name. I can't spend all my time with my birth certificate plastered on my forehead. I did not watch the rally. I think that one of the wonderful things about this country is that any given moment, any group of people can decide, you know, we want our voices heard.
Welcome to the three-ring circus known as the Savage Nation. You know, the news is the Northeast, West, and South, as you well know. That's where the acronym news comes from. Many of you don't know that, but I remember learning that when I was a kid. I was a news watcher since, you don't know this, over 60 years I've been watching the news. Would you believe that? I mean, you say, all right, so what, should I hide it? I have been watching the news virtually every night for over 60 years. And I remember watching the evening news in New York City as a little kid eating my dinner on a tray after a day at school. There was, going back to Cronkite, Roger Mudd, some of the other iconic figures. I've been watching the news for well over 60 years, so I'm not new to this business, okay? Now, I had an interesting exchange this morning with the director of a news service from one of the major networks who said that I criticized them for not covering the big event over the weekend, the big rally over the weekend. In fact, I never said they didn't cover the rally. What I said was that the major media underestimated the crowd by several hundred thousand. And I specifically only mentioned CBS, saying it was 78,000 people, when we know there were between 600,000 and a million people there. So once again, I saw the bias, even in the polite letter to me, which was very polite, and my reply was equally polite. But the point is that I've been watching the weather vane, Northeast, West, and South, with events from all corners of the world for well over 60 years, and I continue to do so here on a daily basis on the Savage Nation. Yes, I come inherent with my own biases. I do. I admit that. I grew up in another time. I grew up in a time of a truthful anti-communism, when there were communists who had infiltrated the government, when there were communists who had infiltrated Hollywood, despite what the leftists have revised and to give it the lies that there were no communists, that the McCarthy witch hunt was invented. It's a total falsehood. There were communists in American government. There were communists in the film industry and in the press. Now, how do I know that that's true? Because approximately 10 years ago, former KGB documents were released in a book called The Venona Papers, where former Soviet agents admitted as such that they had placed spies, in essence, soft communist fellow travelers in the news business, in publishing, in academia. So you say, well, that's over. We're not worried about communism anymore. Well, if you believe that, you are mistaken. We have Fidel Castro, a dictator for well over 40 years, who still hates this country and the freedoms in this country. We have Chavez, the communist dictator. We have the communist dictator of Bolivia. We have Kim Jong-il, the madman of North Korea. We have the communist / capitalist government of China. And so if you think that the battle against communism is over, I only have to refer you to the White House, where several very, very prominent neo-Marxists are employed by Obama in a non-parliamentary fashion. He hired them as czars, as you well know. And their job, their goal, is to change our way of life, to steal freedom from the people and give almost all the power to the central government. Now, thank God they're not doing very well with their designs. They're not doing very well owing to some severe and honest criticism that is coming from only a few areas of America. Thank goodness it's still here. Now let's look at the news. Incidentally, today being the Tuesday of the week, remember I promised you yesterday we're going to change the format of the Savage Nation somewhat, where each day is going to have a specialized kind of focus segment in it? Well, Tuesday was about books, movies, literature, art, whatever. And I'm going to show you how it's all related to the news in a minute. Wednesday is we're going to try and do finance and money with an expert. Thursday, we're going to take nutrition questions. And Friday, we're going to read from the Bible, again, in one segment on each of those shows. And that'll break the week up. It'll diversify the show in a way that'll keep me interested. And frankly, I don't know why most of you listen to talk radio anymore, because I get people emailing me who are, really very, very hot on the news, very hot on radio, and they don't listen anymore. They say they can't listen to it. They cannot listen to most talk radio because it's the same thing every day. They don't want to hear it anymore. And I know this. Believe me, I have the best stethoscope in the business. And so I'm going to diversify my show in areas that I have knowledge and interests, because then the show will become far more interesting than simply politics day in and day out. It doesn't mean I'm going to eschew politics. I will do politics, but not every second. So what's in the news right now? Well, four Jews were killed in Israel, exactly where Obama forced the Israelis to remove a checkpoint. That came out within the last hour. Four Jews, including a pregnant woman, were assassinated by Palestinians who want to upset any peace talks. And they were killed exactly where Obama forced them to remove a checkpoint. Did you know that? You won't see this tomorrow on ABC, CBS, or NBC. This I can guarantee you. And five more American troops were killed in Afghanistan. Did you know any of that? You didn't know about that? There are some other crazy stories out there. I mean, I can't read all of them to you. The Storm Earl could force U.S. evacuations ahead of Labor Day. We've heard about that. Iraq says it's independent as the U.S. ends combat. The only winner in Iraq has been Iran. As I feared when I wrote my book, Liberalism as a Mental Disorder, I said this could turn out to be the greatest military blunder in American history. And I think it is. Bush's Iraq venture, or adventure, if you wish to call it by its proper name, Bush's Iraq adventure was the greatest military mishap in American history, because the only winner has been Iran. Why do I say that? Because you have to understand that Saddam Hussein was a Sunni Muslim in a nation that was largely Shiite. Saddam was a dictator, and he controlled the majority Shiites with terror and terrorism, kept them under control. He was a counterbalance to the largely Shia nation of Iran. And I feared that after Saddam was toppled, the Shiite population would be liberated, which it has been, and unified with Iran, such unification has not yet been completed. So the big winner here is Iran. They've expanded into the old borders that go back to ancient Persia, all as a result of Bush's military misadventure. That's what I fear has happened here. So what I want to do today for you is talk for a minute about books, because I'm going to show you some things about books that you may not, I think you'll find them interesting. Let's put it to you that way. I can't really, give you a big overview of why I'm doing this. If I could only find what I'm looking for, here it is. We're going to talk today about Illusions of Grandeur by people like, Mayor Bloomberg. Mayor Bloomberg is an example of Illusions of Grandeur, for example, okay? You'll see why I say that in a minute. Illusions of Grandeur. And Mayor Bloomberg is perhaps the greatest exemplar of such illusions. Then we're going to talk about allusions. Allusions and illusions on the Savage Nation. Now, I'm not trying to turn this into a college course, but many of you need a break from the news when you turn on the Savage Nation. You like the stories, you like the this, you like the that, and where I go with things, you never know where it's going to go and such. But I want to talk about illusions and allusions, and I want to start with illusions, most notably Mayor Bloomberg and politics, meaning Bloomberg and the mosque. A writer for WorldNet Daily asked me to send two lines about Bloomberg and the mosque. It was Aaron Klein, and I said, here's what I sent them a long paragraph, and here's what I wrote. I said, Bloomberg's expansionist business interests in the Middle East are well known. That he would spit in the face of the memories of the victims of Islamic terrorism by not only supporting the extremists and agitators who want to build a victory mosque at Ground Zero is one insult. Another is Bloomberg calling those who oppose this desecration of what is essentially a cemetery, various other insulting names, goes to further show the callousness and greed of this naked opportunist. Further, Bloomberg is so out of touch with reality that he actually believes his fifth-grade concept of tolerance and his sing-songy sermons during his Ramadan PR event. Now, I believe that since he believes his own concepts of tolerance and his sermons that he gave at the Ramadan event at Gracie Mansion, he actually believes that this backing the mosque has made him immensely popular throughout America. So popular that he actually will run for the presidency. Now, what this cocoon man does not yet know is that west of the Hudson River, he is despised and mocked. That's what I sent him. So I thought I would share that with you. And now on to, we've gone from illusions of grandeur, example being Mayor Bloomberg. He's not the only politician who has illusions of grandeur. I think many in the media suffer it. Perhaps some could accuse me of suffering from illusions of grandeur as well. And I accept that. I think part and parcel of this business is that unless you have some sort of illusions of self-aggrandizement, you cannot do politics or the media. You can't do it. There's absolutely no way you can't do this with an oversized ego and illusions of grandeur. The difference is that some of us retain some perspective of the realities outside of our own ego, and some of us do not. And those of us who do retain a conceptual differential between, let's say, our own self-importance and what's really going on in the world, I think do a pretty good job of it. And those of us who can't separate our oversized self-image with the world do a terrible job at the media and at politics. Now I want to talk about allusions. Now, what do I mean by allusions? Well, allusions in Western literature. Don't turn the show off because you think you're back in high school. You're just beginning your learning. And I know many people are going to enjoy this. I'm going to give you an example. Let's start with a book title that many of you may still remember. It's called The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway, one of the great novelists of all time. And the title of the novel, The Sun Also Rises, where does it come from? The title comes from the Old Testament, the Bible, Ecclesiastes 1:5, where it's written, "The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose." So Hemingway was a good Midwestern boy who grew up going to church, who had a good solid education, not only in high school, which was greater than most of the college educations today, but biblical education as well, and he used that to his advantage as a great novelist. I'll give you another example of a title that goes back quite a ways. Here is, for example, where's the second one? I'm trying to find the second biblical reference if I can. I don't know if I can find the second one exactly and immediately. I'll just read them as I have them. Okay, so The Sun Also Rises comes from the Bible. Now let's look at the next title, The Day of the Locust. You ever hear The Day of the Locust by Nathaniel West? It was a 1939 novel set in Hollywood, California during the Great Depression. And it depicted the alienation and desperation of a group of people who exist at the fringes of the movie industry. The title, The Day of the Locust, is likely a biblical allusion to certain passages in the Old Testament. The most famous literary or historical reference to locusts is in the book of Exodus in the Bible, in which God sends a plague of locusts to the Pharaoh of Egypt as retribution for refusing to free the enslaved Jews. Millions of locusts swarm over the lush fields of Egypt, destroying its food supply. Nathaniel West's use of the locust in his title brings up images of destruction and a land, Hollywood, stripped bare of anything green and living. And that's another one that may be tied back to the Bible in The Day of the Locust. And when I come back, a few more, allusions in Western writings, and then a movie review, and then your calls on the Savage Nation at 1-800-449-8255. Savage. Booming, they're predicting. And all I can say is they're not gold. I mean, there are eternal. And one of them is what you carry around inside your heart and your head. So that's what I have to say to you. A little bit about books or this and that isn't so bad, right? Or you don't want to do it. So I'm going to just continue and show you some more illusions, or shall I say allusions in Western literature. We talked about the sun also rises from the Bible. We talked about the day of the locust, which is probably biblical in its reference. How about the title For Whom the Bell Tolls, Hemingway's novel about the Spanish Civil War, is an allusion, not illusion, an allusion to a passage from Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions by English poet John Donne. Now, John Donne became an Anglican priest in 1615, and here's what he wrote. No man is an island entire of itself. Each is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thine own or of thine friends were. Each man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind. Therefore, send not to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. So Hemingway took that, and he wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls. How about the book The Winter of Our Discontent, published in 1961, written by John Steinbeck, his last novel? Title, reference to the line, Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by the son of York, from William Shakespeare's Richard III. The Grapes of Wrath, where'd that come from? Another great title, many of you have some memory of it. The Grapes of Wrath is a reference to the Battle Hymn of the Republic by Julia Ward Howe. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Now, what is that all about? These lyrics, to me, refer to the biblical passage in Revelation 25, which is, And in the eyes of the hungry there is a growing wrath. In the souls of the people the grapes of wrath are filling, and growing heavy for the vintage. Wow, does that sound like America today? Do you hear this? And in the eyes of the hungry there is a growing wrath. In the souls of the people the grapes of wrath are filling, and growing heavy for the vintage. So it's not that people are starving in America. What they're starving for is truth. They're starving for leadership. They're starving for patriotism, and they're not getting it from Pinocchio.
Savage.
So here I am in the last day of August and experimenting with the radio show. I mean, I have a tried and true show, third largest in the country, and yet I'm experimenting because unless you experiment and try to make something fresh, it becomes stale. That's all I can tell you. And I listen to enough radio from time to time to tell you it's quite boring. I know many of you want to hear, this about Obama and that about the mosque and this and that. There's only so much I can do of that until I become totally bored of it. And I don't want to do it today. So I'm doing this. I'm doing this because I think it's important. Yes, I'll do the news. Yes, I will touch on it. In fact, I'm going to wager a bet on the Savage Nation right now that I will bet you, as restless as some of you may be, you're looking to get out of the classroom right now and go up to an amusement park and get out of class. But I would venture a guess that many of you, if I were to pick up the yellow pages of my local phone book and start to read under dentists or doctors or restaurants, with an occasional aside equipped to an aside, let's say, on each reading, if it strikes me, you'd sit and listen to a whole segment of me reading the yellow pages. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. One, you love my voice. B, you love my personality. C, you're used to me. D, I'm part of your mental geography, and you can't do without me. You have, in other words, a fixation on my voice and my show. So if I decide to read the yellow pages, and I may do that today. I'm going to try that as well. I may break new ground on the Savage Nation and prove that I can read from a phone book and you'll listen. But what I want to do right now is not read from a phone book. I want to show you some good writing. It's a popular novel. Don't get scared. Don't get frightened when I say book. I know many of you don't read. You just text. And you think that using your two thumbs makes you equal to Shakespeare. But before the two-thumb method, there was a thing called penmanship. Before the two-thumb message, there was a thing called books. Before the two-thumb message, there were movies based upon books. And the other night I couldn't sleep. It was around 1 in the morning. I got up and I watched a movie, and it was Prezi's Honor, which I had seen years ago and forgotten how good it was. And the reason I became fascinated again by Prezi's Honor is because it was written by probably one of the most, the finest novelists that I've ever read in some ways, Richard Condon. Now, he wrote The Manchurian Candidate. He wrote Mile High, which I told you was about prohibition and how it was created, how prohibition had been created by a man who would then take over the rackets of the booze racket. He put in prohibition. How? By funding women's groups who wanted to ban alcohol. And once the alcohol became illegal, he was ready with the smuggling the alcohol. And it's an amazing book, very much like the drugs in America today. Who knows who's funding the anti-drug hysteria in America? What do we really think? Should things really change? Why do you think there's such a battle against legalizing drugs? I mean, I'm not in favor of drug usage. I think it's a curse and a scourge, and it's destroyed our country. But you're at a point where you don't know what's destroying it more, the number of people incarcerated, the amount of police we have watching everything we do, or the drugs themselves. So anyway, he wrote the Manchurian Candidate. He wrote Mile High, and he also wrote Precis Honest. So I started to read. So I watched the movie about 30 minutes, but then I pick up the novel. I just happened to get the three of his books in the hardcover again. I had ordered them. And I start to read Precis Honor, and I found out that the movie was very true to the book. They copied almost the work. Richard Condon was actually one of the screenwriters for the movie. Directed, by the way, by John Huston, one of his funny, while he was still living. And his daughter, Angelica Huston, was in it. Jack Nicholson, if you remember, was in that movie. Now, remember, 1985 is a long time ago. 85, 95, what, 30, 25 years ago. It's hard to believe, right? If I say 1985, you believe it's 25 years ago. I do reversals and backwards now. So I say, 1985, why, that was just yesterday? No, it was 25 years ago. So I said, wait a minute, what does that really mean? Well, put yourself in 1985 and say 25 years ago, that would be 1960. Impossible to believe. Okay, so I'm going to read you from the book, and I'm going to show you what good writing is. Just sitting in that hotel lobby under a shiny green balaboonal hat, which by itself could return millinery to a leading place in the arts, she had slowed down the lobby traffic, as Charlie could see from across the lobby, to -9 miles an hour. He studied everyone who was within sight of her in the room, pitying poor Paulie, and he imagined that he could see old men's eyes getting misty, room clerks and bystanders developing erections, and every woman who saw her realizing that she was doomed to hostile dreams that night. She had turned Charlie's legs to water just by sitting there when he came into the lobby. Now, that's the character, the Jack Nicholson character, and the femme fatale was played by Kathleen Turner, who I didn't think was that fantastic, but Charlie Partan is apparently in love with her, right? Now, I want to read you one sentence when he falls in love with her, and he flies out to L.A. to meet this woman he fell in love with at a wedding, a mob wedding, and he meets her in L.A., and he's courting her now. He's totally in love with her, absolutely in love with her after one day. So they get into a car after a restaurant, and they drive up the Pacific Coast Highway. I'm going to read you one paragraph. I want to show you what writing can do. They drove to the ocean, then up the Pacific Coast Highway, and Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he had ever felt in his life. Do you hear a sentence like this? I'm going to read it again. He's in love now. He's a gangster. He's a killer. And yet he's in love with this woman. They drove to the ocean, then up the Pacific Coast Highway, and Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he'd ever felt in his life. I thought that was an amazing sentence. I don't know if people could even write about love in that way anymore, what it does to a human heart. The illusion of love, because it's all an illusion, as you well know. Remember, I started the show by saying we're going to talk about illusions and allusions today on the program, in Illusions of Grandeur, by example, Mayor Bloomberg. Then we talked about allusions in Western literature, such as The Sun Also Rises in the Day of Logos. So now we have the illusion of romantic love and what physiological and emotional effect it has on this character, which Charlie felt taller, better, greater, kinder, and smarter than he ever felt in his life. Now, maybe you remember those feelings from when you were 17. I don't know. Remember what it was like when a girl liked you and you liked her? Oh, my God. They say the man feels he can conquer the world. Yeah, well, click, click, 3 years later, get back to me on that one. How about when love leaves you? How about when the illusion leaves you? What happens to the man or to the woman when that illusion, that romantic illusion, leaves you? Well, we could spend a lot of time talking about what love is and what love isn't and how it was a rather recent phenomenon. It didn't even exist in biblical times. The whole concept of love is kind of a modernistic idea. There was no love in the ancient days, incidentally. Love, the idea of romantic love, as I understand it, is rather recent. last few hundred years. For most of mankind throughout history, marriage was based upon something other than love, other than romantic love. And you could joke and say based upon lust. Okay, fine. We know that's a given. But it was based basically on a contract between a man and a woman, sort of a business contract, to go into business together, the business of raising a family and building lives. That's what marriage really is at the end of the day. And depending upon your business partner, your business will either thrive. Well, your business partner and luck and circumstances, of course. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. Oh, there's another great line in here. I got to read this to you. Hold it. Hold it. Listen to this one. So we're talking about Prezi's honor. And what's the dedication in the front of the book? Listen to this. You're going to love this one. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships from the book Antigone. Can you believe that? I'm going to read that to you again. Many of you think that you can lock out fate with money, or you can lock out fate with a guard or a security guard, or, you know, calling 911 or being surrounded by powerful people. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships. How many of you have not experienced that in your life? How many of you want to call this show right now and tell me what fate has done to you when least expected? How's that for a show topic? And the phone number, you know, 1-800-449-8255. I'll read it once again. But dreadful is the mysterious power of fate. There is no deliverance from it by wealth or by war, by fenced city or dark sea-beaten ships from Antigone. How has fate influenced your life? When has fate entered your life and turned it from one form to another? From poor to rich, from rich to poor, from health to sickness, from marriage to divorce? You want to go into what fate did to you? Now, I tell you, we all know about fate. Remember I read the story when I wrote years ago, 2 years ago was it already? Psychological Nudity, and I talked to you about the Leather Man. Many of you loved that story because it was so bittersweet. The father's friend, the Leather Man, who rose from the poverty of the Lower East Side where he didn't have a penny, and he became wealthier than my father did by going into a certain business which took off in the 1950s, and he moved to a much better house than we had. We lived in an attached house. He was able to move to a detached house, so to speak, out in Long Island, you know, with a lawn all around it as opposed to an attached wall. Now, that was considered much wealthier. While we had a used car, he had a new car. While we had a flat living room, he had a sunken living room. While we had a phonograph, he had a stereo. You get the picture, right? So things went on very well for him. Soon he had expanded the Leather Man. He had a chain of leather stores. And then lo and behold, as fate would have it, I go away. I go out on my own road. I travel to the Fiji Islands. I leave the entire kith and kin behind. I want to set out on my own road. I know if I stay in New York, I'd be dead within a short... I wouldn't be dead. My soul would be dead. I wouldn't have gotten anywhere in life. I just was not cut from the same cloth as my kin and kith. I wasn't. I was always different. I was always driven by other... Doesn't mean I'm better, okay? It means I'm different. It's as simple as that. So I had to follow my own star. Whatever the influences were, I knew I had to get out of New York. So I left in 67 or so, 68. And the rest was an astounding ride. What a roller coaster ride it's been. What I'm saying is, I come back from that road to the plant collecting, the Fiji, the Samoa, the Tahiti, the plant. And now I'm a man. I have a child. I'm married. I had left when I was still really a boy. And the Leather Man had been riding high. I come back a few years later. I am sitting in my living room. I think my father was dead. Or actually, to tell you the truth, I think I came back from my father's funeral. Truthfully, I mean, I don't remember. A lot of it's jumbled up in my head. And lo and behold, who's sitting there, shrunken up in the chair? The Leather Man, who, by the way, I'm not here to mock him. I love this man. I loved all of my father's friends. There wasn't one man in the entire circle that I didn't have a fondness for. I loved all of these guys. I loved all of my uncles. It was an amazing time. I don't know what's happened to the world. But I had a big heart for these people. They were all kindly, good guys. So anyway, he's sitting there, shrunken down. He was a heavy cigar smoker. And he looks up at me, and his eyes are wandering, and he says, Michael, look what happened to me. Look what happened to me. I didn't know what happened to him. He says, I have nothing. I lost everything. I lost everything. And he wound up living at this point now with his children back in a relative's apartment in the slums of New York that he had left 30 years before. He lost his house. He lost his business. Everything. The fortunes had changed. Fate had changed. And here he was. His eyes were bewildered. He didn't know how this could happen to him. And he looked at me and he said, look what happened to me. Look what happened to me. Then he says this. Then he says, I wish God had only given me cancer instead of this. I said, don't say that. Well, lo and behold, he was dead within a year from brain cancer. That's an absolutely true story. It's in Psychological Nudity. It's an example of what fate is and not tempting fate. And don't ask God for something because he's liable to hear you. So if you want to talk about how fate has interfered or interrupted your life for the good or for the bad, give me a call. I'll be back.
Savage.
Eddie, my love, I love you so. How I want it for you. You'll never know.
All right, so here we are. I said to you, the news, northeast, west, and south on the Savage Nation on the familiar weather vane, and that I've been watching the news for well over 60 years. I can't believe it. 60 years I've watched the evening news, whether it was Walter Cronkite or Roger Mudd and some of the others. I grew up on them. So I'm a skilled news watcher, and that's why I'm not doing the news today, by and large, because the news is in the news, okay? The president's going to give a speech about the Iraq war. And we know what to expect already, and no one expects very much from the president or from any other politician today. Here I just got an email from my good friend James Herson. He said, you, sir, are a freaking genius, and that's not an illusion, maybe an allusion. You know, I got to tell you, a lot of people listen to this show who you would never expect. I don't mean James. I don't know where they listen. People listen on the internet a lot. A lot of talk radio has gone to internet listening. You know that I found that if someone Googles Michael Savage while the show is on, they get it off a station in Cincinnati. They're not even listening to it on a radio station, which is an amazing fact unto itself, which I'll talk about in another time where radio is going altogether. Where everything's going altogether. You know where everything's going altogether. So where was I? Oh, so I was talking about the leather man and what happened to him and fate. That was one of the things. I mean, I've touched on an awful lot in this show so far, and many of you probably didn't know where I was coming from when I said we're going to do books on Tuesdays, but I told you that if we do something that's of interest to me, it will lead back and forth in and out of the news and current events anyway. It's all interrelated. I could read the Bible and show you how the Bible is related to what's going on in the world today. I can show you that in and out and out and in. But again, that's too obvious. That's too hucksterish. And so I'm not going to do it. I don't really want to do the hokum thing. You know, I'm not Marjo. I'm not the Marjo of talk radio. Look up Marjo. It was a very funny movie in its day. You know, the revival tent guy. I don't want to do Marjo. You know, there are people in the business who are very good Marjos. So if you want to call the show, we can talk. I wanted to hear from Fate. That's right. Like if I were driving in a car somewhere in America, let's say I was the man who owned $25 billion worth of gold and I hate Michael Savage and I'm tuning in to see if he's putting me down again and wants me arrested. And all of a sudden, the guy's talking about fate and this and that. And he reads from the book where he said, nothing can stop fate. In other words, was that true? Can nothing stop fate? How many times has fate turned people's fortunes around? People have thought that they were immune, couldn't be touched. So I gave you an example of a pedestrian example in my family constellation, in my childhood's constellation of what fate has done. We're all touched by fate. Now, I don't want to tempt fate, but I myself am not as believing in fate as much as I am in self-determination, truthfully. I truly believe in willpower altering fate. Let me put it to you that way, because if you start to believe that everything is fateful or predestined, well, you may as well, you know, just be a nothing, you know. You may as well just collect the old government check and eat the government cheese, you know, and press D, that's all, and scream about the rich that they owe you something. I have seen in my own life that I had to put a lot of effort into things to move the earth. I don't want to give you the hokey thing, but when I was way down, no matter what I did, I was like there's so much I want to say. This has opened up so much in my own talking and thinking. I don't even know where to begin. I have recently recollected all of my journals. I lost them. I collected all of my writings going back to 1966. I've collected them. And they're all neatly assorted in various boxes. And I don't know whether I'm getting ready to do something or leave the earth. I really don't know why I'm doing it all. I have a new assistant who broke into a storage shed for me and found them. I thought I had lost a lot of this. Every writing I've ever had that's significant, all my journals and whatnot. So I remember the early days of writing and how my life was altered by fate and by certain events. But I remember I had a friend who really never amounted to anything. I don't particularly like the guy. He's a backstabber. I won't mention him. But I remember him writing that life is like you're like a leaf in a stream, he wrote, when we were both trying to be writers. And we're nothing but a leaf in a stream, and we get caught up in the stream, and wherever the stream takes us, that's where we end up as a leaf. That never struck me as the way I wanted to look at my life. It is certainly true that no matter what you do sometimes, things are not going to work out the way you want them. I don't know how many years I tried and struggled in so many different ways, and it was fruitless in some regard. And I used to write in my journals that I am like a wildcatter. I'm like an early Texas wildcatter. And every well that I have drilled has come up dry. And I remember writing it after 15 years of trying to hit pay dirt. I was hitting dry wells. And remember, I had two children. I did everything right. I got the degrees. I got the PhD from a great university. I published books. But society had changed on me. The left wing had taken over America. And no longer did work count. No longer did quality count. No longer did effort count. No longer did anything count other than race and gender. And so they started to push unqualified women and minorities into positions that they were not qualified for. It was called affirmative action. And they ruined my life for many years. The ACLU did it. The ACLU said some will have to find a new way of life. Well, guess what? I did.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Who said I couldn't win as U.S. Senator because I had a funny name. I can't spend all my time with my birth certificate plastered on my forehead. I did not watch the rally. I think that one of the wonderful things about this country is that any given moment, any group of people can decide, you know, we want our voices heard.
The Savage Nation. We've been talking about fate in individual lives and the fate of a nation. And of course, look at the fate of America that a man of this character would have been foisted upon us at this juncture in history. Think about it. Would you have ever believed that a man is unprepared? Let's put aside his far left orientation, which is obvious by now to anyone with a brain and a knowledge of history. But would you have believed that a man with such a lack of experience and with no qualifications whatsoever to be the president of the United States of America would be foisted upon us at this juncture of history, just when radical Islam is rearing its hydra heads around the world? Would you believe this? Could you believe it could happen to us? Well, that's how the fate of nations is determined, through the course of events such as this. So let me repeat. You're listening to The Savage Nation. I wasn't born yesterday. I've been watching the news for well over 60 years. Get the numbers right, okay? I have been watching the evening news in one form or another, whether it was Walter Cronkite, who I've later learned was not the grandfatherly, trustworthy figure I thought he was as a boy. He was a far-left radical wobbly. or more balanced guys who actually like Roger Mudd better. I don't know why. I didn't know politics from the back of my pajamas. But I always liked Roger Mudd better than Walter Cronkite as a youngster. I don't know why. I know everyone has likes and dislikes. It's amazing how you relate to people. But the point is different. I'm not new to this business. I've been in the business probably as long or longer than anybody. Now, I'm not in the news business. Don't get me wrong. I'm in the commentary business. That's my job. I observe current events, and I comment. So how did I become so successful as a writer and as an orator? I don't know. You decide. I'm not asking you to even call on that. But I don't need the radical left, which is distorting the world that we live in for so long that they've even forgotten their own distortions, and they're starting to believe it, and they think that that's real by now. No, I don't need them to approve of me. When my profile appeared in the New Yorker, I thought that I had arrived in a new sphere. Because when I was a kid growing up as a guy who wanted to be a writer, for God's sakes, I mean, people such as, Miles Davis, Aldous Huxley, some of my cultural icons were the only guys I ever knew who had a profile in the New Yorker. And then recently, wow, they're going to interview me for Playboy. So then the Playboy interview comes out. Didn't change my life one iota. Neither of those appearances changed my life one iota. To talk about fate, they had no impact on my life. Not one iota of influence on my life. Didn't change anything. I'll tell you what did alter my life recently. Being banned from entering Britain. That was a life-altering experience. Many of you say, well, why? Why? You should be proud that you're not allowed into England. There are many reasons this is one of the greatest tragedies of my life. Many reasons that I was shocked to find out that a nation that gave us the Magna Carta and such an incredible document as the Magna Carta, which led to our Declaration of Independence, would have fallen into the hands of such far-left radical socialists that they would now put a man who simply speaks his mind in the same category as murderers and terrorists is one of the greatest fateful influences in my life. And you know this. So we now come to today. Come to the Savage Nation today. We know the president's going to speak on Iraq. We know that nothing will come of it. We'll all see him come out. And they'll, I don't know if they applaud. I can't watch these things anymore. They're all canned, and we know what to expect. There are no questions allowed. I feel as though I'm living in a ex-Soviet Union. So to me, it makes no difference. And then when they do allow questions, it's stooge questions anyway. Real questioners are not allowed in there. Why don't you put Breitbart in the audience? Why don't you put some people who really have, you know, journalistic credentials in the audience instead of people who have worked their way into it, like, you know, children in a school, who have played teacher's favorite. They brought apples to the teacher in this, and they ask questions that aren't offensive. That's not the mark of democracy. The mark of democracy is a vigorous, angry debate. How do you like that? That's the mark of a democracy, a vigorous, angry debate that doesn't result in stabbing or shooting. That's a democracy. Not polite, softball questions for the president or for any other politician. The town hall meetings that became Tea Party meetings, that's democracy in action. The fake town hall meetings being staged by Nancy Pelosi's crew, that's not democracy, that's the Soviet Union. So now I've asked you what fate is, how fate affected your life, how fate affects a nation, right? And so I've had some callers. Let's go to New York City, WOR. Jeff, go ahead, please tell us about fate in your life.
Michael, in 1996, I took a job in Two World Trade on the 95th floor. I worked there until April of 2001. Mm. In February of 2001, I got offered a new job, but it was contingent on passing three financial service exams. The first two I passed no problem. The third one I struggled with. I was sitting in my chair at the test terminal, changing answers, totally nervous, and finally, after changing a few answers, I said, all right, enough. And I hit the enter button. I got my score back. I passed within three questions, Michael. Three questions.
Wow. All right. So now you passed, and what happened next?
April of 2001, that was my last day. And that basically got me out of, and to be honest with you, I don't know whether I would have stayed when 9/11 happened, whether I would have gone back up into the building. Who knows? But as far as I know, that got me out of there.
Oh, because you passed the test, you got out of that job in the World Trade Center, you're saying.
Exactly.
Oh, you mean how does fate, like the turns of fate. Well, it's like, what road do you want to go down? You're out for a drive, and you turn one way, and you come home safely. And you don't know whether if you'd gone down the other road, you would have been hijacked or a car blew up or hit by a sideswipe. You know, you never know the highway. So do you believe in fate, or you believe in predestination, rather, or do you believe in self-determination?
A combination of both, actually. I mean,
Right. That's right. There has to be something, you know, how do you determine it? I mean, I used to watch fights. My father was a big fight fan. So every Friday night, I'd watch the fights with him. I could, to this day, remember sitting in the chair with the undershirt with my uncle, and they would be watching the fights. And I would remember to this day, particularly the Spanish fighters. The fighters are Spanish descent. They were largely Puerto Rican descent, some of them, if I remember. They would, beginning of the fight, they'd get down on their knees in both corners and pray to God. They were praying to the same God that God would give them the power to defeat the other man. I thought that was bizarre. You know what I'm saying? I didn't understand it as a child. How could God decide, what, he's praying to him and God likes him, so he's praying and God likes him, yet someone has to win, someone has to lose, right?
Right.
I didn't understand it. Yet the men had to pray in order to derive the energy they were looking for, in order to fight better. To have faith in themselves, that have faith in God. I remember those days. Do sporting figures still pray before a match? Do you ever see that anymore? I haven't seen this in a long time. I mean, I still watch the cage fighting. I watch the the extreme fighting once in a while. I can't watch it for too long because it's too brutal, frankly. I don't like seeing tremendously powerful, good-looking men being beaten almost to death. I don't like. There's something about it I don't enjoy. I don't get off on it. I just don't enjoy it. Boxing I can watch because it's a matter of skill, and they're so closely matched, most of them, that thankfully neither of them come out completely, you know, bashed or dead. I mean, I remember when Kid Gavilan killed someone at Madison Square Garden. You know what effect that has on the audience and on the fighter himself? The fighter who kills the guy never recovers from killing the other guy, by the way. So I'm all over the map. I'm just having a good time today, that's all, because otherwise I'd have to talk about Obama and Marxism and the fate of the nation. I'll do that another day. It's the end of August, already tomorrow, September. Who could believe it? Who could believe it? 2010. So let's go to the callers on the Savage Nation. Portland, Oregon. Jay, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, Dr. Savage. I don't have a story about fate or anything, but I just wanted to tell you that how awesome I think it is that you're going to be deviating from politics and talking about different things over the course of the week. And I thought about my experience I think it was in 98 when Clinton fired some missiles in the Gulf. I was in the Marines, and we were aboard the USS Juno. And, we were all kind of freaked out a little bit. We knew what we had to do. We knew that if we were called to do something, we were ready to go. But down in the berthing area, you know, we knew the severity of the situation. But in the berthing area, we just laugh and joke and have a good time. And what's cool about what you're doing now is that, you know, we know the severity of the situation with our country, with Israel, the global situation. And yet, it's kind of like we're just coming around and listening to you and talking about different stories. Even if you read the Yellow Pages, it's just really...
So in other words, you feel that we're having a good time, which is what the whole point of the show, is that we have to have a good time. We can't be walking around waiting for the axe to fall. I mean, I'd rather we be walking around letting the others fear that we're going to drop the axe on them, but I've given up on wishing for that because of the men that we have, the pipsqueaks running everything. I've never seen anything like it. They never fire a shot anymore. I don't know what we have ships for, but all right, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll wake up one day and be cheerful, cheering America again. Remember the day that Reagan launched those missiles against Gaddafi? The airplanes off the aircraft carrier in the Gulf of Tripoli. Do you remember that? How Gaddafi stopped threatening the world? That was a real defining moment in my life. We sent the aircraft carrier. He sent the aircraft carrier and he launched against Gaddafi. It was threatening America. Well, wouldn't that be wonderful to wake up tomorrow and see that some of our F-A-18s or even B-2 bombers had been launched in the middle of the night against the Hitler of Iran, and all the mullahs went to the 72 virgins. I mean, I don't know whether they all share the same virgins. It's too disgusting for me to even comprehend that. Actually, I've thought about that. If everyone gets 72 virgins, does that mean there's an endless supply of... Is it the same 72 virgins? It can't be, because then there wouldn't be virgins anymore, I said to myself. So there There has to be an endless supply of virgins in heaven. Now, where they come from, I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out. I don't know where they come from. I know men are from Mars and women are from Venus. But where the virgins are from, I haven't been able to figure out. Since there's a billion Muslims in the world and all of them go to paradise where there are 72 virgins waiting for them, think about the do the math. That means there has to be at least 72 billion virgins somewhere in the universe. I don't know where they come from. But that's beyond me, you know, but fate acts in a strange fashion, I said to myself as I thought about it. There's a few other things I could say about the issue, but I'd rather not. In fact, I'd rather just take your call. So let's go to Houston, Texas. Thomas, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. Fate happens. It was many, many moons ago, back in 1978. A young man from Mobile, Alabama, local tough, got mixed up with the law. They told him, Vietnam or get a job and do something right. The only job he could find where anybody would give him a shot was my uncle, who owned a charter fishing boat down on Dolphin Island, this little spot on the Mississippi Gulf, on the Alabama Gulf Coast. This kid got the job. My uncle told him, look, first thing you're going to do is you're going to be a stand-up gentleman. One thing a gentleman always does is carry a handkerchief. And he made sure that this young tough, carried a handkerchief with him everywhere he went. And a couple years later, around 1978, he had gotten this kid, you know, kind of managed up to where he was an upstanding young man. He was contributing. He was going to be in local law enforcement when he was finished with the charter season that year. And one night, that young man was driving back home to Mobile, and there was a horrible, horrible traffic accident right at I-65 and I-10. And he got out of his truck, and he went over, and there was this mangled 74 Nova. And in the front seat was a little four-year-old kid with his head split open. I mean, the brain was showing blood, gore, terrible.
Thomas, this is such an incredible story. Can you hold on? I want to hear the rest of it, but I have such little time. Can we take a quick commercial break, come right back? We'll be back in a minute. I can't wait to hear the rest of this story about fate on the Savage Nation. So before we took a break for the wonderful advertisers that support this program, I had an exchange with a gentleman from Houston, Texas, who was telling us about a young man who was in trouble with the law, who was hired by his uncle. And when we tuned out, well, Thomas and Houston, tell us where you were. Years later, the man was on a roadside. He came upon an accident. And what happened?
He came upon an accident. There was a four-year-old boy crumbled up in the bottom of this destroyed car with his head split open. He remembered he had a handkerchief in his pocket because his boss, my uncle, had always taught him to be a stand-up guy and carry a handkerchief. He put the handkerchief on this little kid's head and held his head together, and the paramedic said later that the only thing that saved the kid's life was him holding his handkerchief on the kid's head. That little kid was me, and he had no idea.
Oh, my God.
He had no idea.
Oh, my God.
Until years
later.
But because my uncle had made this guy into a gentleman from some young tough, he ended up saving my life.
Wait a minute. This is amazing. Your uncle told him to always carry a handkerchief. The handkerchief saves your life. Of course, he didn't know who you were when he saved your life, right?
That's correct.
And, of course, after it happened, your uncle knew it was this kid, correct?
Well, the ripples went quick. The news of the accident that almost killed me got out to my entire family, and he said, you know, and he saw him the next day at work. He said, yeah, I'm sorry, I was late. I overslept a little because I was up late, and told him the story about the wreck, and it was just one of those fate.
So that's absolutely fate. There's no question a story like that is about fate.
Yes, sir. It's 100%.
Absolutely. I mean, wow, that opens up a whole sequence of things in my own life, in my mind, about things I've heard with people, how one little here it is, a handkerchief saves a life, and it's your uncle's nephew, you.
Yes,
I'm flabbergasted, Thomas. That was an amazing story, perhaps the most amazing story I've ever heard in my years on the talk radio circuit. Thanks for sharing that with us, man. That was amazing. Back in a moment on the Savage Nation for your fate story.
Savage.
Devil or angel, I can't make up my mind. Which one you are, I'd like to wake up and find.
It is the Savage Nation, so we're talking about fate. Little diversion here. The 50 wealthiest lawmakers. increased their riches as economy sputtered in 09. Who was the top of the list? None other than the lover of the poor himself, John Kerry. Senator John Kerry tops the list for the second year in a row. His estimated minimum net worth, $188 million at the end of 09, up by more than $20 million. Of course, he speaks the loudest for the poor. Isn't it interesting and intriguing that those who speak the loudest for the immigrant, the illegal alien, the poor, happen to be the wealthiest? Quite interesting to me how that works. Some went up, went way up on the list. New faces in the top wealthiest 50, including Rep. Patrick Kennedy, drunk Rhode Island. I mean, Democrat Rhode Island. D stands for drunk. Oh, Democrat. Representative Patrick Kennedy, drunk Rhode Island, who received an inheritance after his late father, Senator Edward Kennedy, drunk Massachusetts, I mean Democrat Massachusetts, died in 2009. 27 Dems with 23 Republicans make up the 50th richest in Congress. They don't tell you how many each has. That's the bulk of Kerry's wealth is credited with his spouse, Teresa Hines Kerry, who inherited hundreds of millions of dollars after her late husband, the ketchup baron, Senator John Hines, R.P. in Pennsylvania, died in a plane crash in 1991. I like Heinz ketchup. I don't like Hunt's. It's funny how one product is better than another. I always try like Hunt's. Like certain products, you try the other. Nah. The worst was hippie ketchup. Remember the years that you tried hippie ketchup? There was no sugar in it. Disgusting. They made it with something. I don't know. Corn this. I didn't know. No corn syrup. Give me corn syrup better. I mean, in a sense, I don't eat it. I hate corn syrup. It's not good for me, but if I'm going to have ketchup, I want it to taste exactly right. So a little bit of the money for a little coinage goes into Kerry's pocket. What can I do? I'm going to be guilty over it every time I have a hamburger? You think I think of Kerry? Nah, not really. I don't. Like when I watch Saving Private Ryan, you think I thought of Spielberg's politics? Not really. Nah, I'm not into boycotts. But there's other products like that where one is excellent and the other one is you can't eat it. It's in sodas. It's in beers. It's like drinking water. I never drank anything as bad in my life. How does that beer survive? They don't advertise. Neither of them do. I mean, I like a certain Dutch beer. I like a German beer, a Dutch beer. Ethnic thing. And the beer stinks. Who drinks beer with a lime in it to begin with? Why do you need a lime in the top of a beer bottle? Who ever heard of such a thing? Whatever. Got distracted. We were talking about fate. It's all personal taste. Scotch. You want to talk about scotch? Your favorite scotch? Please don't do that. I'm going to get the drunk. I'm right here at Rhode Island now. I got to tell you. You run out of money there with that scotch talk. I got to tell you. Yeah, I like this. Glenfiddich, I like. So, The news and reviews. News, views, and reviews. I defined that as such on the Savage Nation when I was a local talk show host. That was already stolen, too. Then I said 3 weeks ago that the stupidest man in the media in history is a guy named Rick Sanchez on CNN. Yesterday I read it, that Rush said it after I said it. No one even knows who says what anymore. Who needs credit for it? Who was the Chinese writer who said it doesn't matter who gets credit for your ideas as long as your ideas are expressed? Who was that? Lao Tzu? Was it Lao Tzu? But that was before entertainment law, before patent law and things like that nature. Today they would sue. Lao Tzu would sue today. The only reason he said it was there was no law to protect him. He was ripped off immediately. His ideas were stolen. You can't sue for an idea, by the way, unless it's applied to a device. A device. You can't sue for a title is what I mean. I've had many a book title stolen. Sometimes I'm reluctant to even think out loud on the show because they wind up on various episodes of South Park or wherever. And they don't even know. I don't think people don't even know they get them from me. That's the idea here, is that so many ideas come flying off my wheel. Spinning wheel. There's a wheel. What do you call it? A sharpening wheel? I'm always sharpening my thoughts on a wheel, and the sparks fly, and people pick up a spark, and they think they thought it themselves. But all right, so you influence people. I hope it's for the better. That's all I can say. Take a look at what happened to the Democrats as a result of me. Take a look at them. My hammering the Democrats did it to them. I don't care who gets the blame for it. I'm glad that others have gotten the blame. It doesn't matter to me. I was talking about Marxism and communism before this guy had the blackboard and the chalk. I'm glad he's such a good student. He doesn't even know where he learned it from, which is even better. It's like the Mask of Zorro. India's economy races by 8.8%. Russia's economy grows 4%. Our unemployment rate, double digit. America, we've gone from the Rust Belt to the Bust Belt. Write that down. It'll be on the, what show will that be on tomorrow? From the Rust Belt to the Bust Belt. And I'm not talking about big sis, believe me. I mean, I'm not talking about that. I mean, talking in the sense of economic, you know. Kerry tops wealthiest lawmakers at 188.6 mil. Who was the man behind the Ground Zero Mosque? I already covered that 2 days ago. There's a lot of words I can use for him. I like this story. Ron Paul questions whether there's gold at Fort Knox and the New York Fed. Why? I'd be surprised if I found out they didn't sell it off while you slept. They gave it a Goniff job. Why? I'd be shocked to find out Rubber Lips. Alan Greenspan, I call him Rubber Lips. You ever see him during an interview? A constant smirk and a rubber lip. A mirthful smile and a rubber lip job. Yeah, him and his old lady there on MSNBC. A real pair. It's like Bonnie and Clyde. Alan Greenspan and Andrea Mitchell are the Bonnie and Clyde of contemporary times. But today they sell it in nice. They package it in nice. I'm a nice guy. I'm nice. I'm for the poor. I'm for the immigrant. Don't touch me. Don't touch me. I'm for the poor. I'm for the downtrodden. How does their wealth go up? How does Dianne Feinstein get richer and richer and richer while she's for the poor and the downtrodden? How does Boxer get wealthier and wealthier and wealthier even though she's for the poor and the downtrodden? You can't figure these things out. I'm actually in favor of increased wealth. It tends to make people better politicians. Look at Bill Clinton. When he started out, he's probably radical leftist in college. And I'm not talking about Petroni syndrome either. I mean, Peroni syndrome. When I say radical leftist, I'm not referring to Peroni syndrome. I am referring to his politics. But as time went on, he became president. Then when he left the presidency, he started getting $200,000-$300,000 for speeches. It changed him for the better. When you think about it, I mean, he still left the Senate, but the guy's a centrist in some regard. He's probably more centrist than George Bush is when you think about it. When you take a look at what Bush did to the economy. But wealth is good for people. It tends to make them sober, except in the case of people like Soros, it makes them even crazier. In the case of a man like Soros, all of his wealth made him more insane than ever, in my humble opinion. The man cannot get enough wealth. He's like Scrooge McDuck swimming in gold. He takes baths in bathtubs filled with gold coins, I would imagine. Remember Scrooge McDuck? Based upon the Dickens character, Ebenezer Scrooge, to talk about allusions, how we started the show. Allusions, and the president's about to speak. Pinocchio is about to speak on the Iraq war. So let's go back to today's topic. No women. How do you like that? I talk about fate, you think women would call. They're not interested. I mean, I have estimated 8 to 10 million listeners. So you figure out of the 8 to 10 million, there has to be 30 women in the country who listen. 30, 40 women. That's a joke. Sometimes I run into women. The women love that joke. They stop me and they say, I'm one of the 30 women who listen to your show. Oh, I got a pain in my side. I hope it's not fatal. No, I'm joking. It was a bad turkey sandwich I had for lunch from a local market. I hate cold food. I hate cold food. I can't stand it. I couldn't eat any more hot food. I'm sick of Chinese. I'm sick of Japanese food. I'm just sick of it all. So I said, all right, and they said, go get me a turkey sandwich. Horrible. I made a mistake. Ugh. Sandwiches are impossible to digest. I need hot food. I was watching a show last night on how cooked food altered altered human beings' fate. I couldn't believe it. It was very interesting. I mean, I'm not new to that discussion because I remember Claude Levi-Strauss's anthropological great book, The Raw and the Cooked, where Claude Levi-Strauss, in his argument, stated that it was cooked food that changed mankind, the course of human events, which it did. Prior to that, there was raw food, and how the fire itself and the cooking of food changed man. I mean, civilization was altered, etc., and cities were built as a result of the cooked food. Now, that's very interesting, particularly when you see us going backwards with the lunatics in the various left-leaning areas of the world, in America, where the schmucks are eating raw food and they think they're superior. And they come up with cockamamie discussions about enzymes. The enzymes are only found in raw food and not in cooked food. You take a look at them, they're emaciated. They can't go to the bathroom. They can't reproduce. They got pimples at the age of 50. They don't have a girlfriend. They don't have a boyfriend. They don't have a dog. But they eat raw food. They have no idea what they're talking about. Raw food is good for you. And they talk about it with a certain religiosity where they're positive that they know what they're talking about, that the enzymes are only found in raw foods. And when you cook it, you destroy the enzymes. Rubbish. In fact, the opposite is true. If you know how to cook, you're actually releasing enzymes that are trapped in foods, incidentally. I'm not saying boil out all of the vitamins from food, but I'm talking there's a way to cook and preserve the vitamin content of food. But anyway, so the raw and the cooked side, this is an interesting side note. They do a study with, I think, mice in a cage, which, well, what are mice? Right, whatever, they have nothing to do there. They kill mice. That's why I left pharmacology back in 1968, because I had to pith the brain of mice and I wouldn't do it. You don't realize who you're listening to. I worked in a laboratory, and I was a grad student making $300 a month as a fellowship. That was a total money I had, and the evil professor said to me, now you have to kill the mice after the experiment, or I'm going to fire you. I said, you can't do that to me. I'm 6,000 miles from home. I have no money. He said, I don't care where you're from, what you're doing. You're killing the mice after we run the experiments. I said, well, I'm not doing it. He said, you're fired. So you talk about fate? I left the pharmacology lab because I wouldn't kill the mice. I refused to kill the mice. They were so cute. And I said, what the hell am I going to do now? I have no money. I have no fellowship. I've lost my fellowship 2 months into the year. I'm 6,000 miles from home. Well, I wandered the halls of the university. I wound up in the basement looking at jars of roots and herbs and leaves. I thought they were interesting. This one said Samoa, that said Fiji, that said Tahiti. And I wandered into a very nice laboratory, a nice man's laboratory, or laboratory's office, a very nice man. And I asked him, what the heck is this? I said, I'm in a science building here. What are all these roots and herbs? He says, well, those are collected down in Samoa by a certain professor we have. And he sends them back to us for analysis where we're looking for medicines. I said, what is that called, that field? He said, well, it's called ethnobotany. I said, you're kidding me. Then you get paid to do that? He said, yes. So because I wouldn't kill mice, I shifted over to botany. And I wound up doing ethnobotany. And I wound up traveling to the Fiji Islands and Tonga, where I wrote my master's thesis on the ethnobotany of Tonga, which is still a classic, a minor classic. It was actually published in a journal from Harvard University when Harvard was still Harvard, which it still is, by the way, in certain areas of science. And that was my fate. I wouldn't kill mice, so my fate took me in the direction of botany because I didn't think I'd have to kill anything. And of course, I mean, that's what fate is. I mean, was it fate, or was it me driving my own fate by following my own lodestone, so to speak? You want to put it to you that way, or my own compass? And that's it. I mean, life is interesting how it is. And now I'm at a turning point in my life again. And I think that within the year, by the end of the year, a new fate's operating in my life right now. And I believe something new is coming in my life. I've been thinking a lot, dreaming a lot about singing. I told you that. And I'm aware it's coming from. Remember I told you last week I was dreaming I was in the street singing? I was an itinerant singer singing opera. Not even for money or acclaim. I wasn't winding up in the Lincoln Center singing opera. I was singing in the street for the enjoyment of singing opera in the street. Why? What do I know why? Last night, again, I dreamed I was singing somewhere. I mean, I have a good voice. It's not trained to sing, but I may take up singing and leave radio and become a singer in the streets. Just become an itinerant singer. I don't know what I'm going to do. But anyway, here I am with Teddy. I do have a very large entourage, or posse, as they call them today. As you know, very many people in talk radio are surrounded by important people. They travel in bulletproof cars, and they have bodyguards and entourage running after them with Starbucks and very important cell phone calls. Yes, I'll take that. No, I won't. Let them go to hell. I don't want to speak to them. No, I'm not taking that deal. I'll take that deal. Who is it? I have such an entourage. It's a 10-pound poodle named Teddy. That's my entire posse. I shall return.
Savage.
Volare. Oh, oh. E cantare,
oh, e cantare,
del blu, dipinto,
dipinto del blu. Everyone follow the bouncing dollar. Follow the bouncing dollar. The Obamas are back from Martha's Vineyard. There's a little too much cherry vanilla, obviously. Boy, they hit the Haagen-Dazs. Ming, take a look at that picture. Wow. I can't wait for the lecture on health foods tomorrow in the vegetable garden. They would have banned Haagen-Dazs from the White House. Take a look at that picture. I'm sorry. Whew. Bing, packed on about 25 pounds over the week. That's with the rain. You know, you're locked in. You can't exercise. You can't do egg rolls out on the lawn. Egg-on-tade. Welcome back to the programo. Oh-ho-ho-ho-ho-ho. So I didn't talk much about politics yet on the show, and the press is about to give a big speech. Oh, hey, everyone's going to hear it soon. Pinocchio's going to tell us we're better off, that we're out, even though we're in. And even though he's pulling him out, he put more in. He took him out of here, and he put him in the north. He took him from the south, and they're liberated. Now they can do their own thing. Although we're leaving 50,000 from the south and the north in case we need a ready force immediately to invade Iran. We've already pulled them out because there's no need, and it's already a success, and they're doing great. And now Afghanistan, and although 8 men died in the last 2 days, we're doing better than ever. Although I came to power on the idea that Afghanistan was where the real fight was. Now that I'm there, I want to get out of there too, because I really truthfully don't want to fight with anyone but the conservatives in America. It's the only real battle I've ever believed in. And Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod have trained their entire lives not to battle Al-Qaeda, but to battle the conservatives in America, in the streets, in the media, and everywhere else. That's why we're pulling out of Iraq, to devote more time to attack the Christian conservatives and on every front in the United States of America. That you won't hear in the speech from Pinocchio. Instead, you're going to hear, I don't know what you're going to hear. Who knows what you're going to hear? Look who's the lowest of the cable news ratings. Isn't that sad? Anderson Cooper. It's sad in a way. Good-looking boy like that. How does he wind up on the bottom? Look at those numbers. Look at the numbers. They're saying they're pretty fixed. Leprechaun's on the top. Next to him is corned beef. Then comes the professor. And all the way on the bottom, if you look at the cable ratings, is Cooper. That's very bad for 581,000. That's like nothing. When I had a weekend show on MSNBC, a Saturday show on MSNBC lasted 3 months. I had 1 million people, 800,000 to 1 million. I mean, you could get that. You could run test patterns and get 1 million people on cable news. Test patterns would get 1 million people. So you take a look at Larry King, 600. He's drooling on himself. Hardball, 620,000, a front man for the radical left. Nancy Grace, psychotic, mental hospital. Deranged. You look at the eyes, you know. If you look at textbooks, I swear to God, if you go into some of those textbooks, absolutely Nancy Grace's eyes, right in there. On the double psychosis with vanilla ice cream. Larry King, there's a medical a chapter on Larry King, but it's not in medical textbooks. It's in psychiatric textbooks of people with a certain complex. The rest we won't even talk about. I mean, there's no point in mentioning them. There's enough already. Look at an actor. Calls for satanic death to Fox News and GOP leaders. It's on Drudgery. Some actor had a big hit in the 1980s. You know, it's an amazing thing. Just as the women who were once beautiful, when they start to lose their beauty. Remember I did a quotient? The lower the derriere, the higher the liberal quotient in women. It was like Goldie Hawn. At her peak, when her derriere was higher up, she had no politics at all. She was happy just to be the narcissist and the exhibitionist, the center of attention. But as time and gravity caught up with her, as it does with all of us, and her derriere started to collapse, her liberal quotient, her LQ, went up. It's the same with the men. As their book ability starts to diminish, their brain power starts to go with it. So here's an actor calling for the satanic death of Fox News and GOP leaders. Hasn't been in a good movie in 15 years. I guess he thinks he's appealing to the doyens of Hollywood. They're going to give him a new job by hating Fox News and the GOP. Good luck, Charlie. Well, that's it for now on the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Yeah!
those who said I couldn't win as U.S. Senator because I had a funny name. I can't spend all my time with my birth certificate plastered on my forehead. I did not watch the rally. I think that one of the wonderful things about this country is that any given moment, any group of people can decide, you know, we want to, our voices heard.
Well, there you heard it with your own ears. Pinocchio, who has an illusion of being president of the United States, which is accepted in Saudi Arabia, China, and in West Hollywood. But frankly, the latest polls show that most of America has come to their senses with regard to Barack Hussein Obama. And we're going to talk about illusions and allusions today on the Savage Nation. What do I mean by illusions and allusions? Bloomberg has illusions that are bordering on the magnificent. Some would say there are medical conditions that could describe Mayor Bloomberg of New York, in that it's called self-aggrandizement or such, because someone asked me today to write a few lines on Bloomberg and the mosque, and here's what I wrote. Bloomberg's expansionist business interests in the Middle East are well known, that he would spit in the face of the memories of the victims of Islamic terrorism by not only supporting the extremists and agitators who want to build a victory mosque at Ground Zero is one insult. Another is him calling those who oppose this desecration of what is essentially a cemetery various other insulting names, goes to further show the callousness and greed of this naked opportunist. Further, Mayor Bloomberg is so out of touch with reality that he actually believes his fifth-grade concept of so-called tolerance and his sing-songy sermons during his Ramadan PR event at Gracie Mansion has rendered him immensely popular. So popular, they may even run for the presidency. What this cocoon man does not yet know is that west of the Hudson River, he is despised and mocked. You know, we've talked a lot about the Ground Zero Mosque and the debate that still is raging, but you don't know much about the developer, Sharif El-Gamal, who won't accept that building the Victory Mosque somewhere else is the only solution.
Who are you?
I'm an American. I'm a New Yorker. Born in Methodist Hospital in Brooklyn to a Polish Catholic mother to an Egyptian father.
Let me make sure I have this straight. You're a Muslim who married a Christian girl. Your mother is Catholic, and you joined the Jewish Community Center on the west side of Manhattan.
I did. That's New York, though.
In fact, the agitator claims this will build bridges.
This facility that is being debated all around the world is universally known as the Ground Zero Mosque. What do you call it?
It should be universally known as a hub of culture, a hub of coexistence, a hub of bringing people together.
Apparently it's a bridge to anguish, because it didn't cross his mind he was building on a graveyard.
Did it occur to you when you were putting this together, that was two blocks too close to a place that many, many people feel very strongly about?
Not at all. It did not even cross my mind.
That's ridiculous, and I don't believe him.
The president himself has agreed that you have the right. Some people question the wisdom.
It matched the needs of my community. It matched the needs of my Muslim brothers and sisters, my Christian brothers and sisters, my Jewish brothers and sisters.
He says brothers and sisters.
And work in Lower Manhattan.
Do you intend to go ahead with the project after all of this?
100%.
70% of America is opposed to your mosque on Ground Zero. Now listen to Imam Rauf playing the psychologist.
In the aftermath of 9/11, when you try to bridge relationships between any two sides where there has been tensions reaching such a level, one of the things you have to do is to explain to each side why the other side feels angry, whether it's, you know, marital counseling between a husband and a wife,
You don't add to the problem by shoving a mosque down the throats of those who lost loved ones on 9/11?
I have taken upon myself the role of bridge builder. To be a bridge builder, you have to have an ability to, you have to have a foot on each side of the divide if you're going to.
We know which side of the divide you're on, Mr. Raouf. We have become so deracinated from our language and our culture, and yet the literature of the past 100 years is brimming with references to the Bible and to the past 1,000 years of English literature. From the sun also rises to the bonfire of the vanities, the word of God resonates in our novels to this day. I'm going to read from Preetzi's Honor to show that the literature of the English language is actually, well, as near as 1985, was still alive and well even in popular fiction. I'm also talking about a movie I saw the other night called The Unforgotten. And what it is about is a death-worshipping cult in Mexico. And what you don't know is that this Satanism is coming across the border along with the illegal aliens. Certainly many of the immigrants are Catholics, but certainly many of them are pagans, if not outright Satanists. And the Mexican death-worship cult shown in this film, The Unforgotten, is symbolic of the cultural death we are opening ourselves up to by not sealing our borders. Now, the liberals claim the illegals come here to work and are all family-oriented Christians, but behind the cross is the worship of death in many cases. Liberalism is the doorway to paganism and Satanism. It is setting the country back hundreds of years.
Savage.
Well, Obama's giving his big speech on Iraq, but let's not forget that his economic plans have failed. There's still record unemployment, and things don't seem to be getting better anytime soon. I'd like to bring on columnist Jack Hunter to discuss Republican John Boehner's recent remarks about Barack Obama's non-economic plans. Jack, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you, Michael. You know, House Republican leader John Boehner made headlines when he suggested that President Obama should oust his economic team. Now, I think you and I and most conservatives out there, and even people who are conservatives, would generally agree with John Boehner. President Obama should oust Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and White House Economic Advisor Larry Summers. They have not done a good job. People are waiting for the jobless rate, the unemployment rate, to get a little better than it is. It hasn't happened yet. The White House keeps promising that it's going to happen. Nobody can generally disagree with Boehner's main point.
Yeah, we have that clip. Play it.
We've been told that the president's economic team is exhausted. And already, his budget director and his chief economist have moved on to where they're about to. Clearly, they see the writing on the wall, and the president should too. President Obama should ask for and accept the resignations of the remaining members of his economic team, starting with Secretary Geithner and Larry Summers, the head of the National Economic Council.
Resign? None of this gang should have ended up holding the reins of power in the first place. So Boehner criticizes Obama's economic team. So what?
Well, it must be said, Michael, that this is smart politically. Going into the 2010 elections, President Obama is unpopular. This is certainly a smart thing to say on John Boehner's part. For the Republicans who are looking to sort of pick up a few wins, not only in the House, but in the Senate, and people are questioning what's going to happen, you can't blame Boehner for being smart strategically. What I have a problem with and would like to bring up and remind us as conservatives is, realistically, what does this mean, given John Boehner's past and his Republican Party and what they represent, if you catch on or get the drift of what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. When the Republicans held all the cards, what did they do with them?
Well, let's just have a little history lesson here. You know, it was President Bush's economic team who thought, you know, in the early part of this decade that it was a good idea to lower housing interest rates to help minorities be able to afford more housing. And it wasn't just minorities, but that was part of the Bush program to get allow more Hispanic and African Americans to be able to purchase homes. So they lowered the interest rates. All sorts of people were buying homes that they could not afford. And lo and behold, we had a housing bubble not too far after that.
That's right. You know, Jack, this doesn't surprise me. But despite all the Republican hot air on fiscal responsibility, you're saying their involvement helped start the housing bubble in this crisis? I totally agree with you.
That's right. If we're talking about economic teams as it relates to the president, that's something Bush did early on. It was a disaster. It has a lot to do with why we are where we are now. I know a lot of real estate people who are out of work right now, and I'm sure you do too. Let's fast forward. When we're talking about TARP, that was a Republican economic team. If you remember, the Republican presidential nominee, John McCain, went to Washington, D.C., joined with President Bush and his economic team to pass TARP. Of course, Obama and the Democrats were there as well, and so was John Boehner, and that's sort of my point.
Mm-hmm.
And even though President Obama defends TARP now, and some Republicans, it must be said, like Mitt Romney and others, say that TARP was absolutely necessary, most of us out here in the grassroots and your Tea Partiers and your serious conservatives know that it was a boondoggle. It was a corporate payoff to the big banks. It was taking money from the little guy and giving it to the big guy, and that was a Republican administration doing that. Who's to say that if we had a President McCain right now, he would not be introducing his own stimulus plan as Obama did, which has a lot to do with why we keep heading in the wrong direction in terms of government largesse and spending money on things we shouldn't be spending? Who's to say he wouldn't do that, considering the fact that TARP itself was considered to be a stimulus deemed necessary by a Republican president, and quite frankly, Republican leaders like John Boehner were there every step of the way saying the same thing.
I've said since the election, McCain was put up to lose. I still believe it.
Well, that's absolutely right, and I just think it's worth pointing out, look, you know, you have the Republicans and you have the Democrats, and they're certainly worthy Republicans like Jim DeMint in my own state of South Carolina. He is a fiscal hawk. You could count on him. But it's worth remembering our recent history when guys like John Boehner are suggesting that Obama should oust his economic team. And he's absolutely right, he should, looking at what John Boehner and his president's economic team did to this country. You know, Bush was every bit the micromanager that Obama is today. Obama's just doing more of it. These presidents build upon what the last one did. Government gets bigger. We spend more money. The economy doesn't get any better. And they keep expanding the size of the federal government in order to fix the problem. Obama's doing it like nobody's business, bigger and worser than any president. But we must remember, when guys like John Boehner are trying to score political points, you can't blame them for that, that they, Bush's Republican Party, of which John Boehner was an integral part of, had a lot to do with why we're in this certain, the particular economic problems we have today.
So Boehner throws out the criticisms, and the Obama administration responds in typical fashion. Play the Biden clip.
Mr. Boehner is nostalgic for those good old days, but the American people are not. They don't want to go back. They want to move forward. And so, folks, I'm still waiting for what it is that they are for. The large tax cuts of the Bush years, the last decade, were scheduled by law when they were passed to expire this year. Put another way, unless the Congress affirmatively reinstitutes those tax cuts, they go away. Not because of anything we did, but because of the way the law was passed 10 years ago.
Typical, typical, typical. The Democrat answer to everything, raise taxes, raise taxes, raise taxes. These people can't be serious because the American people are far smarter than that.
Well, the vice president is correct to the extent that Boehner's comments might be out of line, but not from his perspective. What the vice president is saying is that Boehner is not doing a good job in playing ball by wanting, oh, I don't know, another stimulus with Obama and signing this disastrous jobs bill and all this sort of stuff. Biden and Boehner are as much part of the problem from just two different sides of the two-party head we have there in Washington, D.C., which is the larger point. Biden is wrong, ultimately. Boehner is wrong, or at least hypocritical, ultimately, and that's what I'm getting at. These administrations rely on what they call experts. You know, Obama's not an economist. John Boehner's certainly not an economist. But these experts pretty much come from the same backgrounds and give the same bad advice. Who's to say that Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers are doing anything drastically different than what McCain's economic team would do? I say get rid of the advisors, get rid of some of these economic teams, and be sort of Barry Goldwater-like and get government out of the way altogether. A president cannot control the economy and often does more damage than he does good. Not even often, almost always.
I've been talking about the Democrats and the Republicans for years. To me, they're very much part and parcel of the same problem.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. As you often say, the Republicans and the Democrats, that's exactly right. You know, John Boehner, what he said, here's the quote, "It's time to put grown-ups in charge. It's time for people willing to accept responsibility." He's absolutely right, and that is as true for the Republicans as it is for the Democrats. They have both got us into this situation, and we as serious conservatives need to recognize this, not because Obama's wonderful or John Boehner's wonderful or vice versa, but because we need to recognize that when Republicans get in power again and hold their feet to the fire, there's nothing in his background that would tell us a guy like John Boehner would not go back to being the same sort of Bush Republican and putting up with every bit of economic nonsense we're seeing right now with Obama as long as it was under an R banner. And that's my greatest fear, and we need to remember that when these guys make these political plays.
Well, exactly. I complained about the Bush spending agenda for years. There was nothing conservative about it. I called it fiscal socialism.
All in all, you can never blame the Republicans for scoring, you know, political brownie points with voters going into 2010. That's exactly what John Boehner's doing. His main criticism that Obama should fire his economic team is absolutely 100% correct, and it's just a shame that guys like Boehner and his party couldn't have said the same thing when George W. Bush was doing it, and that's what as conservatives we must always remember.
Jack Hunter, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
It was good to be with you, Michael, and for to learn about this and more, I encourage your listeners to visit SouthernAvenger.com. Y'all take care.
Look, just like I've been saying all along, just because they have an R next to the name doesn't automatically make them a true conservative. You know that.
Savage.
Okay, so we're talking about illusions of grandeur in with regard to politicians. And Mayor Bloomberg is not alone with that. It seems to be a an occupational hazard. The problem is that we're facing very dangerous enemies. We're also talking about allusions today on the Savage Nation, not only illusions, but allusions. And today we're doing books, movies, literature, and such. Wednesdays will be finance. Thursday will be nutrition and health. And Fridays we're going to do a segment on religion and the Bible in order to change things in the talk radio. So what illusions, allusions in Western literature did we talk about today? For example, the title of Hemingway's novel, The Sun Also Rises, happens to come from the Bible, the Old Testament, Ecclesiastes 1:5, where it is written, "The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose." And Hemingway was, of course, one of the great novelists of all time, by any estimation, except by the revisionist degenerates. And so he understood the greatness of the Bible and used that for the title of his book, The Sun Also Rises. But that's not the only example. There are many references throughout literature, English literature in particular, that are not only biblical in origin, but also derived from the great writers who derived much of what they wrote from not only the Bible, but from the Bible. For example, "For Whom the Bell Tolls." Where did that come from? Well, that's the title of Hemingway's novel about the Spanish Civil War. It's an allusion to a passage from Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions by English poet John Donne. Donne became an Anglican priest in 1615. And what did he write? Remember now, we're talking about popular books, For Whom the Bell Tolls by Hemingway, came from John Donne, which in 1615 Donne wrote, "No man is an island entire of itself. Each is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thine own or of thine friends were. Each man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind. Therefore, send not to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." I mean, I got chills when I read a thing like this. This is literature compared to what we are facing today in this country. How about the next title that we're talking about, allusions? The Bonfire of the Vanities, as I said, came from Ecclesiastes. The Day of the Locust, where did that come from? Where did the Winter of Our Discontent come from? Or where did the Grapes of Wrath come from? Well, all of that, all of these, you know, titles were discussed today and will be discussed on the Savage Nation. And so it's a contemptible situation that we live in when Goebbels Jr. is allowed to come to this country and build a temple in this country, a temple against the will of the 70% of the people. A temple to what? A temple to division? A temple to hatred? a temple to drive one religion against another, because that's what he has done. With a little help from Bloomberg and the stupid left-wing comedians in the American media. That's your Mr. Ralph. And so there it is. He talks about terrorism, and he says that we are the terrorist nation. And you know, when you have an impasse like this, it's called war. When one side says you're the terrorist and this side says you're the terrorist, eventually what happens is the two sides go to war. And yet we're told now that the man spreading that gospel of hatred against America is a man of peace, a man who wants to bring the races together. We're told his wonderful wife, Daisy Khan, who is as uncompromising as they come, she won't submit to anyone's opinion. It's only her opinion. I want that mosque, and I want it built there, she says. And you're not going to stop me. And anyone who stops me is a bigot. Anyone who opposes the mosque is an anti-Semite on steroids. Anyone who opposes the mosque is un-American, she says. Therefore, Nancy Pelosi jumps in, the genius herself, and she says that we should conduct an investigation of all those who oppose the mosque. So the Democrat Party now joins the fanatics and says that they want a McCarthy-like witch hunt of all those who oppose the mosque. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very important case. I realize many of you don't want to hear it anymore. You have to understand how important this is. And one of the reasons this is still ongoing is because it is not over yet. It came out, as I said to you, that these people are in it not only to promote hatred, not only to go back to their home countries and show a great trophy of victory that they built a mosque literally on the ashes of 9/11, but now they're going to use public funds to do it. Turns out that they found a way through Bloomberg to use public funds to build the Ground Zero Victory Mosque. The Muslim Center, they're calling it now, it's a center. Planned near the site of the World Trade Center, could qualify for tax-free financing, a spokesmouth for Bloomberg said, and his spokesmouth is willing to consider approving the public subsidy. The Democratic Comptroller spokesman Scott Sieber, another super prize of humanity, said that they support the project. It says, if it turns out to be financially feasible, and if they can demonstrate an ability to pay off the bonds and comply with the laws concerning tax-exempt financing, we'd certainly consider it, said Mayor Bloomberg spokesmouth Sieber. Now, the mosque's backers hope to raise a total of $70 million in tax-exempt debt in order to build the mosque. Tax laws allow such funding, listen to this, for religiously affiliated nonprofits if they can prove the facility will benefit the general public and their religious activities are funded separately. The general public. Now, wouldn't the general public include Christians, some of whom eat pork? Wouldn't the general public include the large Chinese community in the lower Manhattan who love pork and other such products? I would say that if these fine examples of humanity who are behind the mosque would agree to permit a Chinese deli that hang various products from the butcher shop in their product of their products in the public center, I would say it would benefit the community at large. Did you hear what I just said? Tax laws allow such funding for religiously affiliated nonprofits if they can prove the facility will benefit the general public and that their religious activities are funded separately, separation of church and state. So in other words, how can you justify, how can you state for a moment that this mosque, which is being masked inside a community center, a public center, will benefit the general public, when in fact you know that the very same Muslims who are behind this would say no to the sale of any pork or pork products in such a general public center. So now you understand that there's big money behind all of this. We showed you and disclosed on the Savage Nation the connection to the Middle East that Bloomberg has. His expansion of the Bloomberg Empire in the Arab Muslim world goes on. This is all tied into his desire to placate his friends in the Middle East. I have so many good callers. Let me jump to them right now. San Francisco, Lance, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to discuss why I think people find that Teddy is so popular out here in the Savage Nation. I think it's because, of course, you're a political independent. I think you're personally independent, but you are not independent of that dog. You have given that dog some control over your life, and this makes you very human to us out here on the other end of the radio waves.
That's very, you mean you see the vulnerability in me and that, and I have such affection for him?
Yes, quite right. And I'm curious, how did Teddy react to you when you were ill? Did he provide protection or some sort of a vibe?
He wouldn't leave the foot of my bed. They couldn't get him off the bed even to eat for the first 2 days.
Right.
No, I'm telling you, it's awesome. You got to understand that when they say man is dog's best friend, there's something to that. The dog would not leave the foot of my bed.
And Teddy is your number one fan. So, of course, we out here in the Savage Nation.
Well, he is. He really is. If they, I'll tell you, I think he's going to be banned in England next because he could be a threat to the bulldog.
Good grief.
What if Teddy goes over there and barks about freedom of speech? It's liable to upset the English bulldog who has been neutered now with the invasion of the folks from Pakistan.
Well, don't worry,
the Pakistanis
Michael.
Seem to be running England right now.
You have a greater independence from England than you do from the dog. It occurs to me.
Well, yeah, I'm banned in England, but I don't know if my dog could get in there. Maybe they let him in, not me. Maybe I could send him over on a surveillance mission.
Rabies issue.
I don't know. Anyway, I'm glad you listened to me, listened to the show. Thank you very much. I'll be right back.
Savage.
For years, I have told you liberalism is a mental disorder. For years, I've told you most of them in the media are drug addicts. For years, I've told you all of them are Marxists, with rare exception. But I had no idea that the deception was this great. When I woke up and I saw that, although with my own eyes, I saw a million people at the rally, and it was reported by, I think, CBS that there were 17,000 people there, I said it's far worse than even I, who defined this entire problem many years ago, than even I could have imagined. It's worse than I thought. And then we wake up and we hear that the bicyclist, Pinocchio himself, says that he paid no attention to the rally. Now, what president of the United States of America would pay no attention to a rally of a million people, but intervene in a Ground Zero mosque for a very small number of Muslim agitators? In other words, he intervenes in an agitation situation in New York City and says he's in favor of building a mosque at Ground Zero. That attracted his attention. But when a million loyal Americans march and say, we're not going to take it anymore, you've wrecked the economy, you're destroying our national security, we don't want this anymore, he says he's not paying any attention to them? Now that shows you the trouble that we are in. We'll keep talking about this and other topics on the show today, but let's stop for a minute. I know you listen because this is one of the last places you can get real, honest, independent, conservative opinions and unfiltered news. And I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today. Okay, rock and roll. I want some rock and roll, real rock and roll. Give me some real rock and roll right now on the Savage Nation.
Oh, life could be a dream.
All the white girls with puppies.
You up in paradise up above.
All the white girls strutting around with eyeglasses and dogs. That's the future of America. Mother had 2-3 children. The daughter's walking around with a dog, like a handbag. The death of the West, Spengler was so ahead of his time. Otto Spengler, the death of the West. He predicted that the Asiatic peoples would rise and that the others would fall. He saw it in 1910, 1912. So, you know, it's part of history. We're all going to, you know, we're in a handbasket. You may as well enjoy it. Here, let me give you an example of one of the reasons we're dying as a people. It's called lawyers. Tort lawyers who put Obama in power, they're one of the special interest groups that put this character in power, are the people who sue everybody for nothing. So here's a story. Wheelchair-bound man sues Bronx Zoo over access. A wheelchair-bound victim says trying to get around the Bronx Zoo is just beastly. Modesto Hernandez filed suit against the Bronx Zoo, claiming that excessive slopes and lack of proper handrails keep him from making his way around the animal exhibits. Can't use water fountains and bathrooms. The lawsuit, which charges violations of the Disgusting Americans with Disabilities Act and the state's human rights law, seeks unspecified damages and an order mandating alterations so the zoo is, quote, accessible and usable by individuals with disabilities. Now, you know it's going to break the Bronx Zoo. I just came from a hole-in-the-wall Japanese restaurant that I eat in once in a while, a little hole-in-the-wall near where I live. Nice guy, Tokyo guy, always jokes around with me, you know. So he says to me, Mike, is there anything you can do for me? He said, there's a guy who goes around suing little restaurants for disability stuff. I said, a gangster, what's his name? And he showed me the guy's name. He speaks broken English, but he had the man's name written down, which I'm not going to repeat right now. He said he broke a few small restaurants up in San Rafael, and now he's after me. He said he's suing me for $40,000, $60,000. I don't know what the number is. He said it's going to bankrupt me. I mean, he's a small guy with a little, you know, hole in the wall. He said, it's just killing me. I said, well, there's very little you can do. I said, I know an owner of a Chinese restaurant was broken by this. I said, there's a criminal class of lawyer, and there's a criminal class of people in wheelchairs that make a living off of this. And he said to me something along the lines of, well, I didn't want to go into what he said. Wheelchair-bound man sues Bronx Zoo over access. So the vermin with law degrees who pursue these lawsuits are one of the main reasons America's dying, period. Now, what's coming next? Are we going to see lawsuits from the blind because they can't be airline pilots? Or lawsuits from the blind because they can't see the Grand Canyon and they want the Grand Canyon to have Braille put on it? What is going to be next? Do you understand how insane this is? I mean, the guy has a right to see the place, but he has no right to sue just because he's got a disability and a physical problem. Is he going to now sue the people of the United States of America because there is no elevator inside the Statue of Liberty? Are the blind going to sue the National Park System because they can't see the Grand Tetons? It's unbelievable to me. A person has limitations. It's sad. So what is it? Everyone else should bend their hands and knees over that? Everyone should get on their hands and knees because Mr. Hernandez can't see the Bronx Zoo? I'd like to see his lawyer's name. I'd find his home address for you. I'd like to see the lawyer's name for this lawsuit. I'll give you his home address and where his daughter goes to school. It's the lawyers. I don't blame Mr. Hernandez. I blame the lawyers, the vermin who come out of these mills with law degrees. So what can I tell you? And the reason he gets away with it is because the presidents can't break. They cannot break the American Trial Lawyers Association, which is a criminal organization, in my opinion. And certainly we need attorneys. Everybody needs attorneys to do business in this country. But cases like this show you why lawyers are hated so. And it shows you why we have Obama as president. Let's go to the callers for a moment. Randall in Chicago, tell us your ringtone tale. What happened?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Savage. I actually received a job as a result of having the liberalism is a mental disorder ringtone on my phone.
You got a job? You didn't lose a job? My God, how did that happen?
Yeah, so I run into an old CEO who I barely had any interaction with, was just being polite and saying hello. The wife happens to call. My phone goes off. He hears the ringtone, strikes up a conversation, said he had no idea I was that bright, making a little joke there. And he's ended up putting me in contact with the right people, and I just received a job offer today due to his reference.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? So you bought liberalism as a mental disorder as a ringtone?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, hey, that's a positive. Now let's move on. Talking about a recent article in the New Yorker magazine, which belittled the language of Winston Churchill. What the sad little author in the New Yorker fails to realize is that his own ancestors might have been turned into lampshades, were it not for a million different acts of bravery, which Churchill's words inspired. That's very, very important for you to know.
All the stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now.
Also in the hopper today in the Savage Nation is a letter I have in my hands from John Culberson, congressman from Texas, who has been trying to get my name removed from the list of murderers and terrorists, since I'm not either, and permit me to re-enter England so I can experience the great dental care and cuisine they are known for. And the congressman sent me this letter today, handwritten. Dear Michael Savage, for weeks my staff has been trying unsuccessfully to schedule a phone call for me to speak to the senior British minister who can make the decision to lift your ban, but the Brits won't schedule it. So I'm going to cold call them and insist I speak to whoever can make the decision and stay on the phone till I get an answer. I'll at least find out what they expect you to do to get the ban lifted. I won't let it rest till I get an answer. In the meantime, I got a Texas Navy hat and a flag for you as you shadow Nancy on her yacht in San Francisco Bay. I hope you and your family are all well. I admire you immensely. Thanks for all you do for America. All the best, Congressman John Culberson, Republican of Texas. So he is my congressman, even though I live a long way from the Lone Star State. He sent me a burgee for the front of my boat, which says Texas Navy on it. I'm going to fly the flag proudly here in liberal San Francisco. That should get a lot of kicks. I think so.
Savage.